Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net.
How did you know that?
I've done my research.
That is true.
Welcome to Outcast World. Today we're bringing you a special episode from the Boys, Boys, Boys podcast. Our guest is Gabriel Clark, one of the stars of Russell T. Davis' provocative new drama Tiptoe, a show that's prompted some serious debate and reflection amongst queer people.
Queer politics.
When Farage says jump, Labour might say how high.
And it's not true. It's offering people false hope.
Sex.
Dating apps have become a breeding ground for the worst of human behaviours.
And culture.
What do you want, homie?
We get together, we be simple.
Simple?
Be simple for me.
He will, like, go nosh himself off.
This is Outcast World.
Have a round of applause. It always makes it a bit more warm. Hello, Gabriel. Love it. Some fans in tonight. Right, Gabriel, thanks very much for joining us here in the gallery.
Thank you for having me.
So, we've got two things in common, you and me. Same university, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Manchester?
Yeah, I went to the Uni of Manchester, yeah.
Oh, nice.
A bit before you, I think.
What did you study?
I did politics and history, but I didn't finish it. I dropped out.
How come?
Just life got in the way, that's what I say. Yeah, I got offered a job, so I dropped out. And I kind of regret it, but what a city to go to university in.
Yeah, and a really beautiful university as well. I felt very lucky. Well, I was there for about a year and then the pandemic happened. So I got a nice little bit of uni life, but then very quickly the rest of it was on Zoom.
Yeah, that did happen, didn't it? And also we've got a similarity with our mums. My mum sings opera. Your mum sings opera as well. Your mum sang Carmen at the Royal Albert Hall. Your dad plays a guitar in a band. You're from Bolton.
Yes, sir.
What did the other kids' parents do?
Not that different as mine. Yeah. I remember at school there was always like, you would be asked, oh, what do your parents do and what do your parents do? And I always felt a sense of embarrassment about it. I don't really know why, looking back, because I feel incredibly proud to come from a very sort of artistic family now. But definitely growing up, I remember sort of thinking, oh God, I wish my mum worked in a bank or something normal. But I think that was maybe just an internal sense of not wanting to feel or be different.
You don't want to stand out, do you, as a kid?
No, and having a mum who is an opera singer and a dad who is a guitarist and just fixes things is quite a different thing. Yeah. But then growing up, like, we had so many brilliant, mad adventures that we'd never, ever have had the luxury of being able to have were it not for that. So even just being like, my mum doing an opera in France one summer and being flown out to this really fancy villa, and we would just stay in a little tent at the bottom of this massive garden, and then my mum would go and sing for them every day, but then we basically had like a free holiday in France one summer, or getting to come and see her in the Royal Albert Halls as Carmen in Carmen was incredible. And then going watching my dad gig and coming home and like going down to the workshop, helping him with some jobs, and then just sitting and listening to him play the guitar. And it was a very, very cool childhood looking back. I feel very lucky.
It sounds like it set you up, and you can see how you go from that childhood to the kind of career that you've got at the moment. You always said you felt a bit different at school. Now, was that the queer thing? Was it the arts thing? Or was it the Sardinian thing?
I think probably a bit of all three. I mean, the area that I grew up in was very sort of homogenous. There wasn't anyone that was that different in any sense. So I definitely felt different, but I guess there's an internal sense when you're queer, I suppose, of an understanding that you're different, but not having the ability to articulate it. And I think so much of that is because of the failings of our education system, or at least when I was at school, just after Section 28 was abolished, there was no discussion at all about being gay, about being queer, about any of those words other than that's not a good word, you shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
So I think the more I sort of started to understand my queerness, the more I in tandem understood that I shouldn't say anything and that I needed to keep it a secret. And even before I knew why, I knew that I had to keep it quiet. And that sense of secrecy and shame, I suppose, grows, and you don't want to feel different as a result of it, and any sense of difference is sort of quashed down. But yeah, probably a mix of all three. And then suddenly going, oh, well, I just want to put on costumes and run around on stage, and like, that's what I want to do. That makes you stand out and that makes you very different. And I felt very lucky in school when I got onto a TV show when I was about 14, and suddenly like the thing that people would sort of pick on you for became quite cool.
Yeah.
So I managed to, I think, slide under the radar.
That happens.
It's very bizarre.
You go from geek to cool overnight because you're doing something. They're like, we saw you.
Yeah. Suddenly you're invited to all the cool people's parties. And until then I used to go and like hide from playing football in PE. We had a brilliant librarian who would like shelter the nerds. And
oh, we could have done with that at our school.
Oh, she was fantastic. Miss Sprawling. She used to, any sort of nerd, she'd smuggle into the library during PE. I went from like that being my life to suddenly being invited to like the cool football kids' parties and not quite knowing how I got in there. But it was because they saw me as something that I definitely wasn't. But yeah.
You'll take it.
I took it. And I ran with it.
You couldn't afford drama school. The Octagon Young Company was around the corner and it was free. It changed your life. Tell us what happened there.
I mean, I think it was a mix of just having somewhere for my mum to put me for a few hours, and also it being the thing that was a gateway to what I wanted to do. And sort of weirdly enough, like even growing up with like musical parents, I didn't want to go into music. I love music, but I'm not, I wouldn't really class myself as a singer. I don't really play any instrument with any level of proficiency. So even though it was what my parents did, it wasn't an immediate like, oh, I'm going to follow in their footsteps and do that. And I think also theatre and TV and acting wasn't something they knew how to help me with necessarily. But then this was on the doorstep. And I remember they came to my primary school, I think. There was someone from the Octagon came and said, oh, we're running this young company and anyone who wants to go, this is the information. And they'd given it to my drama teacher, who passed it on to me. And it absolutely, yeah, completely changed my life. It was called Activate at the back of then. I think it's changed its name now. But it was every Tuesday evening in the Octagon, and they had like different groups for different ages. So I started there when I was probably about 8 or 9, and it, you know, part of it is just playing games, but they treated you like professionals at 8 or 9 and gave you the opportunities to be unpaid extras in the main house shows, like if they were doing Robin Hood or Treasure Island or anything that, like Christmas Carol, where they need child actors. They were just funneling their young company, which to us was amazing. And we were really treated like professional actors. And we had an incredible teacher called Jenny, and then Matt Hassall as well, who now has gone on to run the Almeida's young company, and he's fantastic. And it was just this outlet to start channeling creativity that I think was sort of being expressed, but not quite finessed. And I just absolutely fell in love with creating, not just acting. They sort of gave you the opportunity to make your own work. And a lot of those sort of young company spaces are devised theatre, and they give over that power of creation to the company itself. So very quickly, I think from being young, it was also allowing me to understand that I could be more than just an actor, but I could create my own work. And it all sort of went from there.
To change tack slightly, tell me if this is true. You were at Leeds Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Someone tried to push Ket up your nose because they thought you were your character.
How did you know that?
I've done my research.
That is true.
You must have said that to someone at some point.
Oh,
you
look,
Jet, I've been following you, I've been bugging you.
Was it you?
Wait, it was definitely not me. Is that true? And did things like that happen quite a bit?
Well, it was a really bizarre thing to happen, obviously. But for me, like my time on Hollyoaks was during the pandemic. So when you start, generally you go on a school trip and they say, oh, as long as you're wearing that uniform, you're representing the school.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to be on your best behaviour, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very similar thing when you start a show like that. You're sort of given this handbook And
do they give you a handbook how to?
Yeah, you get like a
how
nice
to not end up in the press.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. And I think I'm quite a vanilla person. I didn't really need to worry about me that much, but they give you this Hollyoaks handbook, and it was very useful. Things about dealing with the press and you know, social media and going out and a lot of things that I think are really important, especially when you're on a show that has got a young audience, about what you're posting and not encouraging behavior, not encouraging, you know, drug taking or like extreme alcohol consumption, etc. But part of it is that thing of like, when your episodes start going out, you'll be recognized on the street and people will stop you and you won't be able to go about your life in the same way. And I read that and I was like, well, it's illegal to go out of my house and there's nothing happening on the streets. And so it was a really weird thing to sort of start a show and be told, oh, your life's going to change. Yeah. And there's no one on the streets. So I spent my first year and a bit being like, well, that handbook was a load of bollocks.
Well, you've got, is anyone, because no one would have recognized you, you didn't see anyone.
Yeah, there. I was sort of wandering around the streets going, hello, no. And then the Leeds Festival was sort of one of the first big events like that year, that when things were opening up, and
the age of the people going to Leeds and Reading as well. Yeah,
it's kind I of didn't realize GCSE, it's basically it? A Hollyoaks convention.
Yes, yeah.
And we went as a Hollyoaks cast, and suddenly we were like
handbooks at the ready. I'm sure
it was insane. Yeah. It was like being properly like surrounded by people, and I've never experienced anything like that. But it was a very bizarre thing to go from. It's starting the show and getting used to doing a TV show and getting used to being on it and going, okay, well, I've got my life and I've got Hollyoaks and nothing else has changed. And then suddenly being in this big field and everyone sort of, not everyone, but
a lot of people,
knowing who you are, but then also a lot of people who are on different substances. And my character on the show at that time was a ketamine addict. And I had someone come up to me and try to shove some ketamine up my nose. Just insisting that I love it and I've never done any drug in my life. And it was just a very sort of affronting way to realize that actually people you don't know who you are, which is like having a weird form of dementia.
Yeah.
Going around and going, do I know you? Like, yeah. I've had a whole conversation with someone once on the way to Euston Station thinking that I maybe sat next to them in maths and I'd forgotten.
They just watch you on TV.
Well, we got to the station. They went, oh, so can I have a selfie? I was like asking them how their mum was, what they'd been up to, thinking that I'd just forgotten who they were. But yeah, very bizarre thing to happen.
So can I take you back to that handbook that you said that you get when you start Hollyoaks, and it's like how to behave, not excessive alcohol consumption, don't say anything particularly controversial about drugs. What does it say? Or does it say anything about political statements and activism on social media? Because this is important to you. You're wearing a Palestinian flag right now. These things are important to a lot of people and they're important to you. But sometimes they don't sit so easily if you're working for a kind of a conventional broadcaster. So did they have any advice for that? And what are your thoughts around that generally?
I mean, not that I remember, but I guess when I started, it was 2020. And I do think everything has become much more difficult now in terms of the way people speak about things, and everyone is much more
angry
and unwilling to have conversations and afraid of difficult conversations, afraid of any sort of controversy. But I there was nothing overt when I got given that handbook saying you can't post about this, that and the other. But I also do think that
If I had,
I don't think it would have stopped me, because I had a really big wake up call when I was on that show, because I'd already come out, and a few months into being on the show, I was asked on Instagram if I was out, and I said yes, and then the next day it was in the tabloids of like Hollyoaks actor comes out as gay.
They love them stories about Hollyoaks actors in particular. There's something about that in the tabloid newspapers that they really enjoy, isn't there?
It's private life.
Yeah,
and. But it was, what was really bizarre was I hadn't come out. I was already out. Yeah. So it was a story that was just completely grounded in nonsense. And I had to go into the press office and talk about it. And it was sort of that moment of going, oh, actually, like what I say does have an impact and people do pay attention. So I'm going to make sure that I say things, especially being a gay man. Like a big barrier to me coming out was thinking I wanted to be an actor, but I couldn't name an openly gay actor. And I still don't think there are enough actors who are openly gay.
There's plenty of gay actors, though.
There are plenty of gay actors, but not many that speak about being gay. And I do think it's because, especially when you sort of look at actors who are sort of like A-list and leads of like action films and Marvel films and like sort of big franchises, it's a case of being a marketable product. Mm. And it's quite depressing to feel like because you're gay, you're not as marketable as our straight counterparts, because they're worried that people won't turn up and watch a film if they don't think that they can get with the person because they're not straight.
It's the same logic that it's been since probably about 1950, isn't it? It hasn't really been updated.
Yeah, and it's a depressing state of affairs, and it made me feel young when I was younger, wanting to come out, that, oh, I can't be out and be an actor. Those don't go together. Yeah. And I feel like along the way, I just sort of forgot about that and then remembered that process of thinking when those articles came out. Articles is a loose term for tabloid nonsense, but when that came out, and thinking, oh well, actually I'm not going to shut up about it, and there are other things that I feel very passionate about, like what's happening in Palestine. And if people are gonna, I mean, I think The Sun once wrote about me making a lasagna, so if they're going to write about
in
what
a good or bad way, it would have been quite
I hope a good way. It was a good lasagna.
Okay, cool.
But if they're going to write about stuff, then, or if I'm at a press event, then I've become aware that actually people will talk about what you talk about.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about the things that I think are important. Not because I don't think I'm important, but I don't really think I'm that important. And I've not got that much to say about myself, but I have a lot of things to say about things that I think are very important. And if people are going to listen to what I'm going to say, then I'm going to use it as a chance to say things that actually need to be said.
When you had those tabloid articles about something that was, it was a nothing really, because you were already out, but did you feel like the opportunity to kind of come out publicly was taken out of your hands by that? And also, did the industry, do you think, see you differently in some ways?
That's a really good question. I've not really thought about it in that way. What was nice was off the back of it, the press team gave me an opportunity to write an article for the Metro about coming out and about my experience of coming out. And that was really nice because it felt like I could sort of reclaim ownership of that. And it was for LGBT History Month. And off the back of it, I started to have a lot of young closeted gay people messaging me on social media, asking me for advice, which was a little bit overwhelming because I partly felt like I'm not actually qualified to give advice. But what was really nice was I could point them in the direction of charities and organizations and helplines that could help them. And then what was even nicer and was really rewarding was then seeing like some people a few months down the line getting in touch and saying, yeah, thank you so much. Like whether it was like a letter that they'd written me that I'd replied to or something on social media, but them saying, oh, I've just come out and it was fine and my parents accepted me, or I've told my friends. And knowing that actually the power of speaking out and the power of being visible and being an actor and using both of those things makes a difference. So I don't feel like it necessarily took that agency away, because I feel like I quickly reclaimed it. But it was a bit of a wake up call to how the media, I suppose, views queerness and LGBT plus people, but I'm not going to be in the closet and not act. Like I can do both. I don't want it to let it affect my career, so I don't really think about it. And if it does, it does, but I'm not going to let it stop me pursuing my career, I don't think.
Jock Knight, opening scene. Walk us through it, please.
Wow.
People have waited through 90 seconds of adverts to get to this.
Well, thank you very much for waiting. So I was in Romania on a job, and it was the day before I flew back. I got an email from my agent saying, hi, Gabe, this is coming for you. Let me know what you think before I say yes to a tape. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Opened the script and thought, I don't usually just get the tape through and I do it. Why has my agent asked me what I think? And so I opened the script, downloaded it, and thought, oh, I'll read it on the plane. It said Jock Knight, and oh, a great title. sat on the plane, and we were on the way back from Romania, flying to Munich Airport on the plane, and they were coming down with the free chocolates. And I thought, oh, well, I'll open the script, have a little look through now. Open the page, read the first page, read the character list, and then flicked to Act 1, Scene 1. And it described these three characters, AJ, Cam, and Russ, under a bed together. AJ, who was the character I played, is riding one of the characters being vigorously double penetrated. And I just as I read the word double penetrated, this lovely flight attendant leant over and just said, would you like a chocolate? I've never closed my iPad quicker. I felt like I was like opening hardcore porn on the plane. And it was so like flustered. I was like, yes, thank you. Like immediately melted in my hand with
the
sweat. She
probably just thought you were like reading erotic fiction or something.
Well, it was very erotic fiction. And then thought, oh my God, I will have to do this play. It was such an incredible play. And I think the real power of that play was it got people in very easily in terms of like getting audiences in for what then became a really important story about GHB and Chemsex.
Yep.
But it did open with a very, very full frontal, very intense, double penetrating sex scene, of which my character was the one being double penetrated. So there was just a whole host of how
naked
would
as
this
well.
Work?
Well, you would have to be naked.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not really naked, because... Really naked?
We were in jockstraps, but we had a fantastic intimacy coordinator, Sam Goodchild, who made it look incredibly real. And it was so fun. When we got to the point where we were doing it in front of the audiences, there was a gag where we would appear on stage and it would look like my character was being penetrated by a singular person. And then it would get to a point where we would reveal under the duvet the second person, which the first act of sort of sex on stage, you sort of hear a gasp. And then when we reveal the sort of person beneath and they realize what's happening, would just be such a huge reaction every night. And it was a really fun
what
way
was
to
the
start
the
play.
Laughter? Like,
but it was very... It was often laughter. Yeah. There was one night where there was a young Hollyoaks fan who'd come with her mum. And I remember at that point, when that reveal happened, there was a ah, and then a so it's often my mum came to watch. That was I could hear her silence. It was always a varied reaction, and because the theatres we did it at the fantastic Hope Mill Theatre in Manchester and the Seven Dials Playhouse in London, both of which are very intimate spaces, and in the Seven Dials is even more intimate than in Manchester, and the audience are very, very, very close, especially for that first scene where you can make very intense eye contact with them. So that was always quite interesting, accidentally catching someone's eye in the middle of being double penetrated. I think
there's been a lot of use of the term double penetrated in
yeah, DP'd. We'll abbreviate.
It's great for the numbers. It's fine.
Well, double penetration.
Be careful, because this will end up on the internet. It's just him saying that in a loop, everyone.
Oh God.
So it's a lot. It kind of I guess how would I describe this? The audience has eaten the cake, and then the play then turns into something completely different. It's about chemsex. Why did you do a play about chemsex?
I mean, it's a really good question.
You don't do drugs.
I don't do drugs.
Except for that one time at Leeds Festival when you didn't take any ketamine.
Yes. I it was something that I sort of knew relatively little about, much to my ignorance, really. And I remember after that flight attendant walked off and I enjoyed my free chocolate, I then read the rest of the play. And as is the same for the audience experience in that show, you sort of are tantalized by the sensationalism of double penetration. And then...
Keeping count.
Great sentence. And then the play really just begins. So I think anyone who comes to watch that show for the sex scenes gets given that immediately. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's not sort of gets woken up, and then the play begins and you're in. And it was so powerfully written by Adam Zane and directed, and it was really, really striking. And it is an epidemic, essentially, of what has happened. It's so scary and so linked to, similar to what we were saying in the first half of the sort of experience of understanding your queerness and immediately it being linked to secrecy and shame and guilt and those things becoming almost addictive. And it's a really difficult, nuanced conversation to have, because also I don't take drugs, but I'm not going to stand up there and say don't take drugs. But there's no regulation of it, and as a result it's incredibly dangerous, and there are people who are ODing, people who are choking on their own saliva and vomit, and people don't know because everyone is high, and really, really horrific, horrible things happen. And this play explored those very, very full on and started some really important conversations, both within the cast and within the audiences that came to watch it. And it was something that I had to do quite a lot of research to understand and to get my head around.
Research. I'm joking.
On the internet. Yeah. Google. There's no in-person research for that. But it was really scary, to be honest, of sort of understanding how easily this can happen and how frequently it happens. And it is endemic. And the play took 2 hours to explore this issue, and it is a very, very complex one. And I think it was something that I felt incredibly proud to be a part of, because it was tackling such a complex issue very head on, but in a really nuanced way, and in a way that I think really sort of fundamentally and really importantly doesn't shame those who engage in it, because sex shouldn't be shameful. And I think for a lot of queer people it is, and you're made to feel ashamed for your queerness. So to be part of something that was interrogating shame, queerness, sex, drugs, and trying to strip away the shame and have an upfront conversation about it felt like a really important job to do. And I felt very, very lucky to be given that opportunity. And it was fantastic. And also there was a lot of double penetration, which was very fun to stage.
So The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, it was written in 1992 at the height of what they called the AIDS crisis. We wouldn't really say that, we'd say the HIV crisis. You performed it in 2026. From your research, and I don't think you're speaking as somebody that is HIV positive or anything, but you've done a lot of research for this, you played the role. What are the differences that you've seen between when the play was written in 1992 and when you performed it in Manchester, yeah, in 2026? With Russell T. Davis watching one night.
Yeah. I think if you'd have asked me that question 2 years ago, the differences would have been greater. Unfortunately, like the Trump administration rolling back USAID and the rise of this weird conspiracy theory of HIV being a hoax that is being pushed more and more, the lack of ability to access life-saving medication, I think it was alarming that there were fewer differences than there were similarities. There were, of course, differences in the rights that we have today, albeit ones that can be taken away, are still rights that we have today that weren't in place when we were writing, when David Drake was writing this show. The play ends with the character of performer in 1999 getting ready to enter the 21st century, which at the time was written before it happened.
Some of us can actually remember it happening.
That was a real interesting scene to do, because we were taking a scene that was talking about some events that hadn't happened and looking at a person's hopes and speculation about where we may be in 1999 going into the 21st century and his hopes for the year 2000 and beyond. But looking at that in 2026 and looking back and looking at this character who's talking about having a civil partnership as such an achievement, and able to look at that fondly and go, oh, wow, he doesn't know that coming along the way is gay marriage and how beautiful of a thing that is, but also how long it will take for that to be fought for. So that was a really interesting scene to take, because there was a real sense of hope that felt almost odd performing in 2026. There was a line where the character looks at the audience and says, you know, you just have to make it here. And he's sort of like holding them all in his hand, and he says, you know, it's good here, it's better, you'll see. And it felt really odd to be performing a piece that was originally the future, now far, far in the past, to an audience in 2026, looking back at the early 2000s. I think a lot of us thinking, oh God, I wish I could be back then, as opposed to now. And I always felt almost quite slightly disingenuous saying it's better here. But it felt like for us that became the question of the play of where are we today and is it better here and where are we going? But in a piece that was all about the importance of activism and the power of an individual to stand up and say no and find a group of activists and the importance of groups like ACT UP, it felt hauntingly relevant to be standing there saying those words, especially in London when we had the fantastic Dan Glass of ACT UP London in to sort of be talking about those things and then having a conversation with them after about what their next movement is and what their next action is and where their next dying is going to be and going, actually, have things actually changed that much? I don't know. What do you think?
What, for people with HIV?
I suppose, for us as a community, are we facing similar battles that we were back then? Have things got better?
I think that they have got better. What I was thinking was missing from what you said there was definitely, you know, if you were told you had HIV in 1992, you were going to be dead within 2 years.
Yeah,
imagine
course.
The impact on the largely young men. You know, a whole generation was wiped out. But, you know, PrEP as well. You know, things that have made things an awful lot better. But it's funny, isn't it? We look back at that. I was thinking before when you said 1999 going into 2000, what a hopeful period the sort of late 90s felt like with kind of like centre-left politics, both sides of the Atlantic. We imagine we'd look into the future and we'd continue to feel better. And things are materially better, but we don't feel like they are. They don't feel like they're going to continue to get better. We don't feel like things are going to continue to improve is kind of... I feel when I look back at that. And I was there in 1999, I was 17. So I remember the millennium approaching and being like, wow. And for people to look back now and go, that's 25 years ago.
Did it feel like a wow thing?
Yeah.
Things can only get better.
To quote Tony Blair's theme tune, and he's very popular now, isn't he? yeah, I know it did. And sadly, things don't feel like they have. Fascinating as well, you know, to do a play like that in the current context as well, I think. Yeah. Tell me about Russell T. Davis. We're going to come back to a little bit more about Russell T. Davis in just a bit because there's something rather exciting that could be a lie, like you being force-fed ketamine that you turned away at Leeds Festival. He didn't take it. We'll come to a bit more about Russell T. Davis in a bit, but the gala night, Russell's in the front row. Almost the entire audience stayed for the post-show conversation. What does that tell you about who's in the room for this kind of work?
I mean, it was such a privilege to have Russell watching, never mind giving up his time to have an in conversation with. And it was a gala night for the George House Trust, which...
He's a patron of George House, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a patron of, and they've been doing incredible work. They were Manchester A's line back in the 80s and 90s. They've been going for 30 years. They are an unbelievable organisation. The work they do is fantastic. And so just to be able to have Russell in the audience, but also have Paul Fairweather and other people who were founders of the Manchester AIDS line, to be able to have those conversations about what is different today, what is the same, and as you were rightly saying as well about, you know, the difference in terms of the being diagnosed as positive today is not a death sentence. But moments like that, performing that play and knowing there were people in the audience who had lost so many people, was such... I've never had that as an actor before, or this sort of responsibility of telling a story that is mine but isn't mine, but there being people in the room who have directly experienced that. And there's a really, really sort of powerful moment towards the end of the play as he's remembering all these people that he's lost and just going through name after name after name, and then sort of telling a little bit of stories about one or two names, but it's just the volume of it. And having people in the audience who were there at the time come up to me and share stories after about people that they'd lost. It almost felt like every night as that show went on, that scene became heavier and heavier because it became also an opportunity to hold the people who had lost people and remember those people as well along the way as this character's remembering people that he's lost. And it was such a joy to have Russell in. We had a beautiful post-show conversation, and we spoke about the show and his work. And I mean, he's been a fearless champion of queer stories since he started telling stories, and it was such a joy to have him on the stage, because we were also interrogating, well, what is the relevance of this story that is deeply rooted in New York to Manchester, and who better than someone who's sort of told the story of queer life in Manchester from the 90s through to the present day to help answer that question.
To take you back to, you have a flag on there, Palestinian flag on there. Not every actor will get drawn on issues like that. A lot of people go out their way to really avoid like getting involved. You posted pro-Palestine content the day your biggest casting was announced. Is that courage, or is that just who you are and who you want to be? Because you've said if your career ends because of it, you don't want that career. You're 27, you've got a lot of career left to risk.
I hope so. I think, just coming back to what we were saying earlier, of knowing that, well, if people are looking at what I'm saying, whether that is talking about LGBT plus rights, talking about trans rights, or talking about Palestine, if people are looking, I think I have a responsibility, especially as a white man, as a British person. Yeah, you know, I've got an extraordinary degree of privilege that I can walk through the world very easily, and I shouldn't and don't take that for granted. But I also have a responsibility as an actor, as someone who's got a platform, to use that platform and to use the privilege that I've got to raise awareness of those who don't have that, and of important things that are happening. So I knew that day, like, I would have people looking at my social media, and obviously I was very proud like posting about that casting and that show, but also it was an opportunity to make sure that I was making sure that narrative's not forgotten. And I'm not expecting that when they, if it's picked up, they're going to say, oh, he's doing this show, but let's talk about this. But you can't ignore that.
Some people will.
But some people will. That's the hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, going to an event, and I think more for me, knowing that that's there from the output, and those are the conversations I'm going to be having. I think the more, you know, if every actor stood up and said, free Palestine, trans lives matter, and spoke out on those issues, they can't sack every actor and not hire every actor. So I think the more of us that do speak out, and the more of us that do stand up and use our platforms, that the sort of easier it is to champion those important causes.
It's safety in numbers, isn't it? I don't know if you've seen, there was a lot of musicians got together to put on a concert to support the cause, I guess, Palestinian rights and what was going on in Gaza. And there was safety in numbers. There were some really big names in there, but there was safety in numbers for them. But, you know, if you take a stand on something like that, there are sections of the press that will gladly attack you. 90% of the press is right wing.
Well, let them. It shouldn't be controversial to say there's a genocide happening, and it shouldn't be happening. But if that is controversial, then at least I know I'm on the right side of history.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us more. There's something we should know, apparently. Russell T. Davis, Alan Cumming, Channel 4, without spoiling, always smiling, that even facial expressions are a giveaway. Tell us what we can know about all of this.
Oh, wow.
Oh, don't groan.
I'm just...
What can I say? What can I not say? Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I can't really say much, but Tiptoe is coming out this year. It's Russell's new 5-part drama for Channel 4.
What can we expect? He's done Cucumber.
So it's nice in a way. It sort of forms a loose trilogy with Queer as Folk, Cucumber, and this.
Love it. So it's Manchester-based?
It's the same world, but it's Manchester-based.
Right, got that.
And as a gay Mancunian... Well, I'm from Bolton, I'm not a Mancunian. But
it's Greater Manchester.
Someone from Greater Manchester. Yeah. To be part of, again, like what we were saying, a group of people who are gay, are trans, are bi, are lesbian, are queer, telling a story that is actually our story, was the best professional experience I've ever had in my life. It's such a magical show. It's heartbreaking, it's brilliant, it's sexy, it's exciting, it's funny, it's full of love, and it's so full of heart and humanity.
And it's in Manchester.
And it's in Manchester. It's all set on Canal Street. It's incredible.
And is it something that it kind of involves? I mean, Russell's not going to put out something with just a load of like cis gay men in 2026, no. Is he? So it's...
The cast is so... Not just the cast, the crew. And I think that was what was really fundamental to this experience, yeah. Was Key Street Productions really made an effort, and they do on all of their productions, to make sure that there was never in any room just one person of any particular identity. And we all end up having a lot of conversations on set about the idea of like, if there'd been one, there's none. And the idea of like being the only gay person on set, you then become aware that you're the only gay person.
Yeah.
So being on set and being part of a cast where there's multiple gay people, multiple trans actors, multiple black actors, multiple like just queer people everywhere, but also straight people and allies, and both in the cast and the crew, made for the most incredible experience, because everyone felt like they had a stake in the story, but everyone felt so empowered by it and excited by it. It was the most incredible filming experience.
Not so you filmed it already?
Filmed, wrapped.
All done. When was it done? Last year?
Yeah, they wrapped in December.
To go transmission on Channel 4 when?
This year.
What time?
I don't know.
Okay.
I actually don't know. Whatever time.
Okay.
Channel 4 this year, soon.
Soon?
I'm sure things will start coming out about it very soon.
Exciting.
I can't say anything.
Okay.
But I can say that it is amazing. And Alan Cumming and David Morrissey will blow everyone up. I mean, they're two incredible actors. That's a given. Both at the height of their game. And they just give the most incredible, like, powerhouse performances, but are so generous and open the floor in every scene they're in to allow every other actor in that show to flourish and bring their A game to everything. It was just such a joy being on that set where you've got so much time to play, and our incredible director Peter Hoare was so generous with his time. I mean, it's the first job I've ever had where we were brought in to rehearse and just given chance to play together and have like bar training, because my character is part of a group of people who work behind a bar, and we were just
so it's partially set on Canal Street as well.
Yes, like, I mean, filming on Canal Street was
iconic.
Especially sort of that lineage of Russell's shows of Queer as Folk, Cucumber, and now Tiptoe. Telling the story of Canal Street and how it's evolved and changed over the years, and this group of misfits working in this bar that Leo, Alan's character, runs. And it was, I mean, just the buzz on Canal Street when we were filming there.
Albert, yeah, magical.
It was incredible. And also the production brought in like punters and drag queens and bar staff to be extras in the show. So we were on set with people who were just regulars in the bar that we were filming in, and it was just mad. Like, you would in between scenes go out onto the street and there'd be people just so excited about the fact we were filming there, and it just felt like such a special experience, and so lovely to have such a sort of like support from the community and an excitement around this show that's not even come out yet.
To connect two things here, Jock Night and Manchester and Canal Street, fun fact, Manchester has been identified as one of the fastest growing chemsex scenes in the UK. It sounds like it's come from an estate agent, though it hasn't. did making this play change how you saw Canal Street? Because it's a different Canal Street to the one that it was when Queer as Folk came out. I lived in Manchester for a period of time. I moved back 10 years ago, and I first-hand experienced the sort of going down the wormhole of chemsex, ended up in hospital, had to go into rehab and everything. It destroyed my life, that whole thing. So it's a subject that's very close to my heart when I see it played out in Manchester. And people just don't realise that you're in some sort of regional city and you think these things are confined to London, New York, kind of San Francisco, but they're not. These are things that are happening on the British queer scene now, and Manchester in particular.
Yeah, I mean, especially during Jock Night, I had a very, very vague knowledge of what chemsex was, and yeah, Jock Night taught me a lot about the detail of it,
yeah,
but really taught me a lot about the extent of it and how how frequently it is happening everywhere, and it is spreading rapidly, and it's very scary. And but I also think it's really good that people are talking about it, because there are incredible places that people can go and get help and get support, and fantastic rehab facilities and groups and therapy, and it's not the end. And I think that's always really important to say. But it's also, it's really great that people aren't stigmatizing people that are going through it, because I think that again compounds a sense of shame and guilt that leads to a lot of these issues happening in the first place. But in terms of like my relationship to Canal Street, not necessarily because of that issue, but it did change it in that I'd not really been out on Canal Street that much before doing Jock Night. Now I grew up in Bolton, so Manchester always felt close, but also very far away. Yeah. And when I came out, it was like sort of just before I turned 20, and then the pandemic happened, and then sort of like my life happened. And before Jock Night, I just realized that I didn't have that many like queer friendships in my life, which was quite a sad realization. But then this show came along and gave me loads. And as part of it, after shows and after rehearsals, the cast were like, right, we're going out on Canal Street. And it was a really beautiful introduction to it, because then half of Canal Street came to watch that show. So still to this day, I cannot walk down Canal Street without someone saying, I've seen you get double penetrated, which is always
say that to
odd.
Everyone down there. That's a sad thing.
Yeah, potentially. And then filming Tiptoe on Canal Street was, again, such a beautiful way to like be part of that street in a way that's not just associating it with going out and mm-hmm. drink, but...
There is a side to Canal Street that needs to be explored that isn't drink, drugs. There is a community there. Let's explore the community.
Such a community there. And I think when you're there during the day, you really feel it. Yeah. And those spaces, whether it's just sort of hanging out next to the Alan Turing statue, or going into Richmond Tea Rooms, or going into the bars that are open during the day and just having chats with people in a really mank way, like everyone wants to talk to everyone. But you're also in a place that is really queer and has so much history. And there are so many great walking tours around there, but any bar you go into, you can just go in and chat to people and have a lovely conversation. And
people will talk.
But I think right now, like spaces like Boys, Boys, Boys and spaces like Canal Street are going to become ever more important mm-hmm. because we are also facing a lot of hostility. And I think queer spaces where you can go in and have a sense of community with queer people are vital, and they are lifelines for a lot of people. And they sort of need to be protected. So I feel like I'm really, really proud to every time I walk down Canal Street, I always feel really proud now, which is something that I've definitely got since doing Jock Night and Tiptoe.
Through doing that stuff, you are now part of Manchester queer royalty, I think.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I would think you are. As soon as you're in with Russell T Davies, you've been on them shows, that's it, you watch. You're too modest. So you told an interviewer that your dream job, this is our last question, is just being employed, but you also let slip very carefully that playing the Doctor wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. You don't know what you've said publicly. I love this. I'm surprising you at things you've said. You've done Tiptoe. You've worked with Russell T Davies. The TARDIS is right there. If he offered, would you take it?
Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, he's not offering me it. That's the thing.
You never know.
Well, yeah, it would be a turn up for the books, but what about you?
Well, I genuinely think it is...
Aren't we on the lookout for a doctor now? I can't remember between
we've
doctors.
We've got Billy Piper.
We've got Billy Piper.
Right, oh, so. Who knows?
She's a temp, I think.
It is the greatest show ever, and I was the perfect age when Doctor Who came back and the Star Wars prequels were coming out. And those two things, Star Wars and Doctor Who, were the things that as a kid absolutely like ignited my imagination and made me want to go into storytelling, because they just seemed so endless and so exciting.
Limitless, aren't they, as franchises, really, storytelling wise?
Totally. And I think sci-fi especially, sci-fi and fantasy, has such a large queer following because...
The world's shit,
but also they present these worlds in which queerness is not an impossibility. There's space to imagine... this like queer reality where being gay exists in a world alongside aliens and other planets and monsters, and being gay is the last thing on anyone's minds. And actually, if there's, you know, a planet of creatures who only speak like weird noises, and like, you know, and like the possibilities are endless. Therefore, there is a space out there where it's normal to be gay, and it makes being gay both brilliant and exciting, and not different and different, but difference is celebrated. And there's such a queerness to shows like Doctor Who that are so attractive, I think, to young queer people, that they provide this safe space where you're not going to get judged. So I think growing up for me, like a character like the Doctor became so enamoring and exciting and safe, was because this is a character that no matter what gender they are, aren't defined by their sexuality, their relationships. They're also not massive and built and stereotypically like
anything.
Yeah. They're free of those confines, and they crucially use words and love and intelligence to solve problems, as opposed to violence and weapons. Mm-hmm. So I think for anyone, that is the sort of hero that we should be looking to. And so of course, like roles like that would be a dream.
When Billy's gone, we'll see. Gabriel, thank you so much for dropping into the gallery and having a chat with us. It seems like it's going to be a really exciting year for you career-wise. So
thank you.
Fingers crossed, and thanks very much. The very lovely Gabriel Clark.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Queer politics, sex, and culture. Outcast World.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.